Welcome to Big Stories of the Mountain West, the panel discussion held at StoryFort 2019, hosted by Boise State Public Radio. It features two reporters and the editor from our Mountain West News Bureau. The Mountain West News Bureau is a regional journalism collaboration that we launched to take a look at the people and the stories of the Mountain West that affect us all. It has funding from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and public radio members across our region. The Mountain West News Bureau was launched in February 2018, and for its first year, it focused on issues that reverberate across Wyoming, Colorado, Utah, Montana, and Idaho. On the panel today are managing editor Kate Concannon of Boise State Public Radio, and reporter Nate Hedgie, formerly in Montana and now with KUER in Salt Lake City, Utah, and Amanda Peacher in Boise, who covers Idaho for the Mountain West News Bureau. We begin the hour with editor Kate Concannon, who answers the question, what makes a story regional in the first place?
So, talking about questions, the biggest question I get asked all the time is, what is a Mountain West story? And there are basically three types of Mountain West stories. The first is sort of easy. It's like themes. You know, what are the big themes in our region? And I would say one of the biggest themes that we cover is public lands. I guess that's a no-brainer to everybody sitting here. You know, every state in our region, huge portions of our states are public lands. So, and there's a lot going on public lands. I mean, you've got wildlife, you've got national parks, you've got oil and gas and coal extraction, which those things mean there's an innate conflict there. So we do a lot of our coverage. I think we could pretty much cover public lands and not cover anything else and still have too many stories to do, right? So both Amanda and Nate have done some great coverage. Do you want to share some of the things that you've done?
Well, yeah, I mean, the first thing you have to understand about covering public lands is that public lands on the face are pretty boring, right? Like, who wants to hear a story about land? But land is, you know, it's the source of power. And whoever controls the land has political clout, political influence. Whoever's lost that land loses power and political influence. And so I want to start by sharing one story set in eastern Montana about the folks who lived on this land before white settlers arrived. So, Frankie, you can play the clip. Thanks.
I meet Mark Azure at his kitchen table on the Fort Belknap Indian Reservation in Montana. He's an Iraq war veteran with glasses and a pockmarked face, and he says round here in Indian country,
well, I don't think anybody's had it tougher than we have.
Outside his window, the reservation sprawls across a cold, snow-covered prairie. It's home to a substandard health care center, a few stray dogs, and a highway. Descendants of white settlers drive past in pickup trucks on their way to towns like Haver or Great Falls.
I don't think they really stop and visit and want to understand, you know, it's kind of like two different cultures trying to coexist, and it hasn't always turned out well.
Azure says before those white settlers arrived, all that land was Nakota, Grovant, and Blackfeet territory, unplowed, a sea of blue gramma grasses and June grasses dotted with massive herds of wild bison.
Buffalo will go way out and use all of the land and then come back to wherever the water is.
The tribes hunted those bison, using the hide for coats, the stomach as a big pot, and the meat to fuel their people. But then the U.S. Army and European settlers swept across the northern Great Plains in the 19th century. They spilled indigenous and bison blood to take those lands, nearly eradicating the animal in a concerted effort to destroy the food source for tribes.
Thank God they didn't. I think they tried both buffalo and Indians, and neither one was successful. So we're both still here.
But a new version of the land was born from those white settlers, one that saw the northern Great Plains as an engine for America, molding the earth and fueling this country with oil, coal, and cattle.
We got to provide food for the world.
So yeah, and obviously that last voice is the voice of ranchers, which at least in parts of the Mountain West, they don't own, but they lease vast swaths of land, and Amanda's had some experience in...
Yeah, we do a lot of stories about the cattle grazing industry, and that means a lot of time spent on the road talking to ranchers and also talking to people who have some big problems with the way that the cattle industry is run on public lands. So I'm going to play a clip from a recent story I did that was in response to the Trump administration deciding to lower grazing fees to the lowest possible amount that a rancher can pay. So this happened a couple weeks ago. You'll hear a little bit of the nuance in the story, but here's how I get into kind of a wonky topic like that. Bob Skinner starts up his all-terrain vehicle. He uses it to get around his remote ranch near the Idaho-Oregon border. It's calving season, so several times a day he drives his land to check for newborn calves.
There's a brand new one.
He spots a rust-colored calf on wobbly legs right next to its mother.
He's standing up all right.
The cow assumes a protective stance as Skinner comes near.
They don't leave them if they're brand new.
The calf seems to be in good shape, so Skinner zooms away. In a few months, Skinner will turn all his cows and calves out to eat grass on public lands. He's happy about the Bureau of Land Management and Forest Service decision to lower grazing fees to just $1.35 a month. That's the price for grazing one horse, five goats, five sheep, or for Skinner, one cow and her calf.
It's not one of our big expenses.
But he's quick to add,
we have big expenses running on public lands.
Things like gas, building materials, and labor costs. Skinner compares it to being a renter whose landlord expects you to pay for maintenance and repairs.
The government does nothing. I mean nothing. We have to maintain all the fences.
So that's how I get into a story that's like, you know, the Department of Interior released this big announcement about grazing fees. What does that actually mean? Well, we go out and we talk to the rancher and we meet the cows, which I have to say, however you feel about grazing on public lands, baby calves are pretty cute.
Let's stay with you, Amanda, because, you know, moving on to another theme that is big in our region, as I say, we could talk about public lands for the next hour, but another big issue is growth. And I'm sure all you guys here in Boise know that you have the fastest growing city in the country. So I know that, Amanda, being here in Boise, you've spent a lot of time doing stories on growth and trying to find different stories than the ones we usually hear, right?
Right. So I could cover how many jobs is Micron offering this year, or how many different apartment complexes are being built in downtown Boise. And not to say that those aren't important stories, too. But I'm really interested in the other side of growth. Who are the voices that we don't always hear from? So anecdotally, I happened to be chatting with my dad one time, and he mentioned that this bar down the street was closing, in part because of the expansion of State Street. And Tammy, bartender who'd worked there for some 30 years, was going to be out of a job. This woman had only ever bartended. And she was just an institution at this, you know, institution of a place. So let's hear a little bit of that story and hear Tammy's perspective on growth.
Turner Sports Fair is your typical neighborhood dive bar. There are pool tables, a pinball machine.
12 bar stools, 8 tables.
The faint scent of stale cigarettes clings to the old furniture.
The bar's all marred up from tequila slammers back in the day.
Tammy Wood has tended bar here for 35 years.
Geez, when I first started, there was 2 beer taps, Bud Coors. Now we have like 10.
What are some of your most common orders here?
Screwdrivers, vodka crayons, simple stuff. They don't order no fancy stuff because they ain't getting it.
The joint bar and tackle shop is in a neighborhood seeing big change. An intersection expansion to deal with increasing traffic displaced Smokey Davis, a local meat shop. Upscale restaurants like Vincenzo's Trattoria are moving in among the burger joints and donut shops. A few months ago, Turner's owners put the business on the market. It didn't take long for the property to sell.
I found out about a month ago.
It was a shock to Tammy Wood. Bartending is all she knows.
I can't even imagine anything different. I walked in here when I was 19 and I haven't left yet.
So I'm happy to say that Tammy did find another job, but she was just a fascinating character to stick with and, you know, sort of an unexpected person to tell that story.
And I should add a regional perspective on growth. All of our states, bar one, are experiencing similar stories to Tammy's. The only state that isn't growing, it's actually shrinking, is Wyoming. And so, you know, how we tell that story for the region, it's like, why isn't Wyoming growing like everybody else in our region? And we have told that story. I'm going to move on to another theme. And the interesting thing about this theme that we're seeing in our region is we didn't expect this one. It just sort of, we started seeing these stories popping up in all of our five states. And that was basically depression and suicide, especially suicide in youth. I mean, I could throw out a ton of stats here that are alarming, but the one that really rang home for me was if you're a kid, a teen in our region, depending on each state, you're 2 to 3 times more likely to take your life. Wow, right? So we've tried to look at that story in a number of ways. Our reporter, Ali Greeley, who's based in Colorado Springs, she's sort of taken on a lot of these stories, right? And again, we're always looking for how do we find people to tell these stories? So she spent the day with a mental health social worker at a big high school that has 2 campuses, 2,000 kids, I think, in Colorado Springs or just outside Colorado Springs. And this poor woman is so overworked. She's got 2,000 kids at the same time that we're seeing these alarming numbers. Funding for mental health social workers in schools, for counselors, has been dwindling. So she, I think, is the only full-time person. So Ali spent the day with her.
Debbie Sell says her door is always open for students.
I'm good. How are you?
I'm good.
Gosh, I don't feel like I've actually talked with you in a while.
Yeah, I've been busy.
Yeah, so what have you been doing?
This student tells Sel she recently got a job outside of school and has a tutor for keeping up with her homework.
So you have a plan?
I do have a plan.
Awesome. Well, I'm glad that you were able to come in and share and that I could check in with you today.
More often than not, this is what Sel offers, a listening ear for students to talk about their lives, the good and the bad.
And please know, like, if it's ever urgent, let me know, like, I need to see you, like, today, before the end of the day, and then I will definitely make sure that happens.
Okay.
Did you get your snack yet?
She says it's simple everyday rapport building like this that helps prevent students on the edge from slipping through the cracks.
One of the things that the community and I think most parents don't understand is that we really do work with kids every day who are thinking about hurting themselves.
A recent medical study showed at least half of parents whose kids had considered suicide had no idea.
And that was another interesting sort of alarming thing when we were reporting this story, you know, that study that had just come out, that so many kids are thinking about doing this and so many of us as parents don't know. So you can count on us, we'll be following this this issue over the next few years. On something a little lighter, which I think we'd need about now, the other thing we cover a lot of is the American West, the culture of the American West, and variety of ways we do that. We did a story just very recently on skajoring. Has anybody heard of skajoring? Yes, of course, it's the Mountain West. That's basically, I'd never heard of skajoring. You take a horse and you take somebody on skis, and then you let them go. I don't know. I'm not convinced. But it's apparently a big sport in our region. Wyoming loves it, but there's other states in our region that have skajoring races. Another thing, of course, is public land. Going back to public lands, is we love our public lands out here, right? We love our parks. We're all about conservation and hiking and cycling and all sorts of things. So we decided we would do a series, and I just asked all my reporters, where's your favorite place in your state, you know, your favorite park? You know, go do an audio postcard. Take me there. Take our listeners there.
I'm standing here on the sandy shore of Redfish Lake on a cold spring evening. The sun has dropped behind the peaks of the Sawtooth Mountains, but it's taking a while for the sky to fade to black.
Well, it's steadily darkening.
Astronomer Matt Benjamin is here to give a talk about the newly protected night sky.
How are you guys doing?
A small crowd gathers on the beach.
We're far from urban areas. And as a result, this is just about as pristine of a dark sky as we get.
A few people peer into a spotting scope for a close-up of Jupiter's moons.
Oh,
they look like pinpricks of yellow light against the black backdrop.
Wow!
Yeah.
I have to say, as a reporter, you get to go to some pretty cool places in this job. Even if, I don't know if you guys can, it sounds like I had a cold when I was voicing that. I don't know if I'm the only one that notices that, but in any case, that was a story about the first dark sky reserve designated in the U.S., which is right here in Idaho. So I got the chance to go and observe some people observing the night sky, and what a privilege as a reporter, and what an honor to be able to bring that to a broader audience. And I think that's one of the roles that we have in this position is, how do we explain the beauty and the immensity of our region and all of the amazing things that are going on here in a way that is relatable and understandable to a broader audience, to our listeners.
Do you want to share? We did a few things. I'm trying to remember all of them. What did you do, Nate?
I went to Yellowstone, and I hung out with a group of wolf watchers, who are these people from all over the country that come to Yellowstone with their giant spotting scopes that cost like thousands of dollars, and they wake up really, 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 really early and watch wolves and grizzly bears and all the awesome animals, and I got paid to go do it, and it was awesome.
How's your wolf howl now?
It is. You're not supposed to howl at wolves in Yellowstone. I'm not saying I've ever done that, but if you were to howl for a wolf in Yellowstone, there's a chance they could answer back, so that's pretty cool.
Coy.
Yeah, I'm trying to remember. I can't remember all the other places we went. We basically had six, but yeah.
Yeah, we had people in canyons.
That's right. Yeah. Ray.
Even urban fishing, too.
Urban fishing, yeah. Mm-hmm. Judy did urban fishing. Yeah, Ray, who is Ray Bichelle, and she's based in Greeley. And she does canyoneering, right, which sounds like a crazy sport to me, even worse than skajoring. It sounds very risky. But she took her... her mic down with her, her equipment with her, and she recorded herself canyoneering. So if you get the chance to listen to that one, that was pretty awesome. So I was talking about the different types of Mountain West stories, starting off with definite themes that resonate. There's also, you know, what we do is we'll look at a national or an international story, and we'll figure out, well, how's that playing out here? You know, there are some obvious ones. I mean, I think it's no secret that as a country, we're pretty divided right now. And there are definitely ways we see that here in the Mountain West. I mean, an obvious example, after the Parkland shooting, there was a lot of coverage about gun control. So we sort of looked at communities in our region, how are they responding. Another controversial issue at the national level is whether NFL players can kneel during the national anthem. As you know, Colin Kaepernick, that was a big thing for him, to draw attention to what he says is police brutality, specifically against people of color. And it turns out that our region probably has the first African-American NFL, or they're not NFL, I correct myself, college football players, to be blackballed. It was in Wyoming, in Laramie, and it was in the 60s, and we have a little bit of that, Frankie. Thanks.
Back in October of 1969, the University of Wyoming Cowboys were 12th in the country and undefeated. John Griffin was a wide receiver.
The minute you step on any field, you're in for a fight for 60 minutes.
I'm sitting with Griffin on a windy day at the university's football stadium. He says it's hard to recognize the place, but other things have stayed with him.
I remember that day as if it were right now.
He's talking about the day he was kicked off the team.
Griffin won't be catching any more passes for the Cowboys. He and 13 other black football players were fired by coach Lloyd Eaton.
You know, lives were turned upside down for this.
It was the midst of the civil rights movement, and the team was set to play Brigham Young University. At the time, the Mormon Church promoted the belief that black people were cursed with dark skin as punishment for Cain's murder of his brother.
African Americans were not allowed to elevate themselves in the Mormon Church.
That meant no church leadership, no missions, and no access to Mormon temples. Griffin and 13 other black teammates wanted to protest the church's policy when they played the Mormon College's football team that fall.
We're not going to be able to put something on our helmets. Probably not going to be able to stick something on their jerseys. But we can certainly wear a black armband.
The day before the match, they met with their head coach, Lloyd Eaton, to discuss the armbands.
We came in. We had our armbands on. And then the coaches come in. He comes in. He walks in front of us, looks at us. Gentlemen, you're no longer Wyoming Cowboys.
Griffin and his teammates were shocked. That night, the players met with the UW Board of Trustees and Wyoming Governor Stanley Hathaway to try and overturn the coach's decision. But the university ruled in favor of Eaton, who said there was a rule that barred players from demonstrating. The next day, Griffin and his teammates watched the game from the stands.
It was pretty surreal. We should have been out there.
And it didn't stop there.
We were blackballed by the NFL.
Fast forward to today, and the NFL has effectively blackballed Colin Kaepernick.
So I don't know about you guys. I had never heard of that story, you know, and my reporter told me about it. And it was like, wow, yeah, we definitely, this is the time for us to revisit that history in our region. Another story that we can regionalize that you're all going to know about that's an international, a global issue is climate change. I feel like we cover climate change a lot. We're often covering stories that are nothing to do with climate change, we think, and then as we get reporting and digging in, we realize, oh, there it is again, climate change. Pesky thing. So Ali Budner, who you heard from earlier, did you all hear about the kids' strike that happened a couple of weeks ago? It was a global phenomenon started by a really interesting kid from Sweden, I think, Scandinavia somewhere. Or kids go on strike every Friday to demand action for climate change. And a couple of weeks ago, there was this effort for it to happen all at once all over the world. And Ali profiled some of the kids in our region. She spoke to kids in every state who were taking part in this this strike. And we just did it as a straight profile. Again, it was going back, telling a story through the people, through the kids. We didn't speak to experts. We didn't speak to anybody pushing back, you know, kids should be in school sort of thing. We just spoke to the kids. And here's a little bit of that.
Some stopped to take pictures of her with their smartphones. Others asked questions.
School for Climate, what are you doing it for?
The crisis that we're dealing with right now.
She's given this response countless times, patiently breaking down the science of climate change to passing adults and explaining why it matters to her enough to leave school.
And I guess I'm fighting to, like, stop the worst effects.
Thank you. Continue to do what you do, and I will look at that climate change. High five, sister.
That was fun. That was the first interaction of the day, and it was a positive one. At least it wasn't like somebody flipping me off like 2 weeks ago.
Coleman was inspired by the growing worldwide movement called Fridays for Future. Students strike from school once a week to raise awareness about climate change. That's what got Haven Coleman's attention and Liam Newpert. He's the 16-year-old state leader for the movement in Idaho.
I had called my mom and I was like, so I'm going to lead a climate strike on the 15th. And she was like, what?
But like many other parents in this teen movement, she now supports him. Polls show young Americans are far more likely to believe climate change is happening and caused by humans. Crossing these identity boundaries is imperative for the climate movement. That's according to Mishka Banuri, a Muslim teen in Utah.
I was so terrified joining this movement because oftentimes in planning meetings, I looked around and I was the only young person and I was the only person of color in the room.
On top of that, she says, in conservative-leaning Mountain West states like hers, the conversations about environmental issues can be more challenging than they are on the East and West coasts.
In Utah, we're really at this basic level where we're still trying to convince people that climate change exists.
I don't know if any of you heard that story and it was missed out at the beginning, but that kid at the beginning is 12. So, another international issue that we have been covering, and Tom spoke of it earlier, was the growth of hate crimes and white nationalist groups in our region generally. Do you want to talk about that?
Yeah, so, I mean, it's the Southern Poverty Law Center earlier this year released their latest hate map, which is a kind of a whole nationwide map of the number of hate groups. Now, they're not the best source, but there is no real comprehensive source in tracking the number of hate groups in the United States. They can also be pretty left-leaning, but professors that I've spoken with, they rely on that data, so it's kind of the best data we have. And according to their data, we've seen a rise in the number of hate groups in parts of the Mountain West, specifically, and I should say active hate groups. So there could be hate groups that are just not active in any given year, but a presence of active hate groups in Utah, Colorado, Montana, and Wyoming, specifically postering and protesting by two groups called Patriot Front and Identity Europa. And so I went out and spoke with a University of Utah student about the time that he found one of these posters.
Mohan Sudipatula climbs the creaky stairs of his dorm building at the University of Utah.
It's almost noon, but he's still wearing pajamas. Class was canceled that morning.
How did class get canceled?
Professor's sick.
Nice. That's
a bummer. Sudha Batula is a senior studying biology and philosophy. He's also the first-generation son of immigrants from southeastern India. And over the past year here at the university, he's felt kind of uneasy. Now he's going to show me why. Sudha Batula digs out some papers from a drawer in his bathroom.
These are them. There's three of them.
Posters he found on campus.
They're all in red, white, and blue. And the first one we're looking at says, not stolen, conquered, and it's a map of the United States.
That one is apparently a simplistic reference to America's history of breaking treaties and taking land from indigenous people. The other posters are more vague.
These posters right out of the bat are pretty clever with their wording, right? Like we were talking about, they don't really come off as harmful right out of the gate, but you go up online and the manifesto is like a direct call of action against people of color.
And so that's kind of the interesting thing about this new breed of white nationalist group is that they're very, their motives are pretty well hidden. They call themselves, Identity Europa recently branded itself to the American Identity Movement, and it's part of this broader identitarian movement that was spawned in France, and it's since spread to the United States, the Mountain West, to New Zealand. It may have inspired the suspect in the shootings in New Zealand. And so this is kind of this new breed. It's not that same Hayden Lake neo-Nazi Spokane type of white nationalism. It's something much more, quiet, I guess, would be the right way to say it. And we've had conversations in our newsroom about how do you deal with that. And, like, one of the biggest questions is, like, do you reach out and do you speak to these groups? I mean, as a journalist, you always get the other side, right? But what happens when the other side is a side that is filled with hate and racism? So we made the decision not to reach out to those groups.
Yeah, I mean, we talked about it a lot. And I mean, it's a conversation that's going on in newsrooms around the country. You know, how do we, you know, do we talk to them, as you say? I mean, what we did in this case is we were very careful that we went to their manifestos, we looked at their literature to make sure that we weren't portraying them inaccurately. They're still cross at us, but, you know. But again, you may find another newsroom where they would say, no, we want to speak to them and we want to hear what they're going to say.
We got a question, actually, that you just answered on Twitter. So just as a reminder, you can tweet questions at us right now, hashtag MTN, that's for Mountain West News, or you can email Kate directly. There's a form on your chair for that. There are a couple others that have come up so far asking more questions specifically about the way we've told stories. And I should point out that we're just playing excerpts here, so there might be one side of a story that you're hearing, but not the other.
Right.
And you're giving us a couple of story ideas on that hashtag, too. So send them along, and we'll talk about some of them at the end, but we appreciate your ideas.
Great. Moving on again, back to themes. So we've covered, you know, the sort of themes that we look at for the Mountain West story. The final theme, you know, after regionalizing an international or national story or a typical Mountain West story, is it's just interesting. And that's like a gut thing, right? Now, I'm always saying to my reporters, when they pitch a story to me, who's going to care about that? Is somebody going to care about that in Laramie? Are they going to care about that anywhere, frankly? I mean, any story that we do, we want our listeners to be engaged. This next story that we're just going to play you a little excerpt from, again, it's Maggie Mullen, our reporter in Laramie. And this is sort of it's sort of a national trendy story, but it's also just interesting. And the way Maggie found this story, she lives in Laramie. She noticed that there was a truck stop next to her that she would go to pick up things occasionally, and it kept selling more and more Indian food. There were, you know, samosas one day, and then the next day there were samosas and pakoras, and then before she knew it, there was an Indian restaurant, and she's like, why, you know, is this happening in Laramie? So she went to talk to the chap who owns the truck stop, and he was saying, oh, well, didn't you know more and more Sikhs are becoming truckers? And we're like, why? Why are more and more Sikhs becoming truckers? And that's why we did the story.
Pandir says it's an attractive blue-collar job for Sikhs like himself because it doesn't interfere with their beliefs or traditions.
You don't have to go
you know, cut your hair, you don't have to take your turban off, or you don't have to, you know, lose your faith while you're working hard.
The soundtrack to this shift in the freight industry is Indian pop music. Sergi Khan's hit song Truck Union has over 2 million views on YouTube.
Trucking is actually becoming a pretty hip industry in Sikh community.
Khan's music video features turban dancers in flashy garments spinning in front of a row of shiny semi-trucks. Khan's lyrics describe working as a trucker as a straight shot to the American dream. Mintu Pandur says a lot of Sikh truckers listen to it on the job.
You know, you can listen to your music all day while you're working. How many other jobs you can? Not too many.
And I loved that story because it had that music in it. Because I'm from an area in Leicester where I grew up listening to that music.
Oh, so I thought I was you grew up right here.
Oh. Anyway. Yeah. So, so I was like, when she had me at the music, basically, yeah, that's a good story. Another type of interesting story is one, you know, we just think it's interesting. And a lot of that is gut and subjective. So maybe they're only interesting to me. I don't know. But you had come to me with one story, right? And I was fascinated by the subject.
Yeah, you never know if when you go to your editor and you sort of nerd out something, if she's going to be like, yes, I also agree that's fascinating, or she's just going to be like, that's only curious to you. But when I was pitching this story about crows a couple months ago, Kate was into it right away. And so if you've been to Nampa recently, you've probably noticed that there are thousands of crows roosting along the boulevard every night. And so the city of Nampa is like, we like you crows, but maybe not all the time and maybe not with all of your waste. So they're trying to figure out how to move them along, shall we say. So I spent an evening with the crow patrol.
The birds swarm in an S shape far above the beams of the parking lot lights. In the distance, more and more crows appear on the horizon as tiny black dots flowing toward us like a river in the sky.
If you just keep scanning to your left, they just keep coming.
I mean, the sky is just full of them above us now. And then, all of a sudden, the crows settle in. They dive bomb from the sky and into the branches of the trees. It's not totally clear why the crows picked here for their winter gathering spot. But natural resource biologist Josh Collette says all the asphalt here absorbs the heat.
The urban setting has created a little thermal hotspot for them, so it's a few degrees warmer here.
There's also the city dumpsters nearby, plus the agricultural fields surrounding Nampa that provide lots of food for the birds. But right now, they're not eating. Thousands of them are sitting wing to wing in the bare trees surrounding our crow patrol. It's a little unsettling. So it's time for the crow patrol to get to work. Johnson brings out his first trick, a laser. He directs a bright green beam toward the roost.
They see it kind of as a stick coming towards them, and it feels like they're going to get hit by a stick, and so they don't like that.
He's right. The crows take off. Johnson says these trees have also been treated with a non-lethal but stinky chemical.
Ew, it smells like grape juice.
You would think that they'd like the grape juice.
Yeah, you would think so, but they don't like grapes, I guess.
The stink kept the birds away for a while, but you guessed it. They came back. Remember, crows are smart. But tonight there's another trick to try. A drone. And I'm going to give this away, but the drone scares off the crows too. And I felt a little bit, you know, these are really fascinating birds, super intelligent. And as I was pitching this story to Kate, she could kind of tell, like, wow, you're really fascinated with them. Let's follow your curiosity here.
Yeah. And I mean, we were just talking about how we decided then to do that story, and I wish there was a scientific way of saying how we decide, but no, it was just we do the stories that we love that we think you will love, essentially. But, you know, there's so many stories in the Mountain West. When I was covering, I used to be a reporter in Canada or an editor in Canada. I've covered other parts of this country, and I covered the West as a whole. But there's something about the Mountain West that I just love. They were always my favorite stories. So I find the challenge, both as an editor, and I think you guys feel it too, is not, oh, gosh, what are we going to cover? It's like, oh, we've all got these big, long lists of stories that we want to cover, and And they keep, then news will happen, oh, that story will go to the bottom of our list. So let's, Amanda, do you want to talk a little bit about how, what our process is in deciding which of these stories are we going to cover?
Yeah, and I think it would be helpful to parse out. As a radio reporter, we're usually doing two different kinds of stories. Most of what you're hearing today are from our features, which are like the bigger reported. We take a couple weeks. We spend a lot of time with each source. Sometimes we get to go in a cave or to Redfish Lake, and it's like we get time for those. But a lot of our work is what we call spot news. Those are the one-minute newscast stories that you hear that are fast, like here's the news of the day, here's what you need to know. And we have two reporters on those spot news stories every day. And so in the mornings, we spend a couple hours looking at everything that's going on. What are the new science studies out there? What's been released today? What is the Trump administration doing? And then we sit down with Kate in a meeting and say, okay, here are our lists. What rises to the top? What's most relevant to our region? And so that's kind of the process for spot news. And then, you know, you might get what would you say, Nate, like 5 hours to do that story?
Yeah, you get about like 5 hours to do the story. I always feel bad about calling sources and saying, hey, I need to interview you in the next 3 hours. I'm so sorry.
I don't feel bad.
She doesn't feel bad.
Well, often it's just that pressure of, you know, we need to get this out now, and it's an important story of today, so talk to me.
I think the interesting thing as an editor is you work with your reporters, and no reporter that I've ever worked with likes to do spots. They hate spots because they're stressful, right? And you can't dig in, and we're journalists, we like to dig in, and there's a limit to what you can do in a day. But, you know, these are really important stories that I think we were saying earlier, and I think Kirk alluded to this yesterday, that a lot of stories aren't getting covered because so much is happening, you know, in Washington. And so many of these daily stories that we're doing are those stories that we want to, yeah, we're not going to give you a big in-depth report, but you're going to hear about it and you're going to think, that's interesting. I want to look into that. The other thing for reporters is I would say 5 or 6 of our spots out of 10 become a feature, you know? So, I mean, you've both had experiences of that, right?
Yeah, well, I mean, just recently we were doing a story about at Arches National Park in Utah. Well, first off, like national parks are getting busier and busier and busier, right? And so they've been trying to figure out ways how can we either cap visitation or make it just a more enjoyable experience so you're not waiting in line for 2 hours to see Old Faithful, right? And so we were doing a story about how it was a short spot about how Arches National Park tried to have this reservation system, but then it was kind of essentially shot down by tourism businesses in the Moab area. And so out of that, we were kind of, you know, asking, well, why are people visiting national parks more and more? And one of the things is social media and like this so-called Instagram effect. Like people want to go and take like that awesome picture of Horseshoe Bend or the Delicate Arch or, you know, Old Faithful. And so now we want to do this story just about the Instagram effect and people that are traveling all across the country just to stop off and take that perfect picture and what that means to kind of our most treasured places and also just what that means to places we kind of think of as being solitude and reflection and everything else where you kind of go inwards. And are we losing that when we post everything to Instagram and then we geotag it and we let everybody else know about it? I mean, this story hasn't even been reported yet, but these are all the kind of questions that are going through my mind as I get ready to go on a reporting trip to tackle it.
So that's an example of like a daily story that's turning into a feature. We have a lot of different ways that we might find feature ideas for those bigger hit stories. One thing I try to do is just be out in the community and beyond my bubble as much as possible. I mentioned a story idea I got from my dad. That's not only where I go. Although my mom gave me a story idea the other day. It was actually a pretty good one. Sorry I didn't respond to you, Mom. I should have. But coffee meetings with sources, just asking people, what else should I know? Sometimes at the end of every interview, I say, okay, we talked about X, Y, or Z, but what story do you think is important? What else is going on? Sometimes I turn off the microphone and I say, okay, that was all on the record, and I could tell you're a little anxious, so like, what's off the record here that I should know about on background, or what other story is kind of in the back of your mind? Because I think it's easy for any of us to get stuck in our own pathways of life, our own bubbles, and we have to kind of force ourselves to look in unusual places sometimes. And in the process, you know, we might have a list of 10 different ideas and be excited about all of them, at which point we come to Kate and say, hey, which of these can I actually do? And she helps us vet those. Do you want to talk about how you make those decisions?
You know, I wish I had a scientific answer for that, and I really don't. I mean, it's really about how does this fit in to what we think the important stories are in our region. And it might be, and I think a good example of this is your homeless story, a homeless student story. Do we have a good voice for this story? Do you want to talk a little bit about that, Sean?
Sure. Well, we did actually, this was another short story, A Spot, where it was about homelessness among youth being on the rise. And gosh, that's a sad story. But I think I talked to an executive director for that spot. I didn't have someone directly experience homelessness, you know, in the six-hour window that I had to report that. So Kate and I talked and said, let's do more with this. This is a big deal, especially in rapidly growing Boise. There are a lot of people who are forced out of their homes because of rising rents. So in the process of a couple weeks of looking for the right person to tell that story, I found Caden Zimmerman and his grandma, Pam Cantrell. So let's hear a little bit from them.
Caden Zimmerman's school days start early and end late. He has an hour and a half long bus ride to get from the homeless shelter where he's staying to middle school.
Wake up 5:45, brush my teeth, do my hair, and then I hurry and rush downstairs so I can get out and catch my bus on time.
Caden is staying at the shelter with his 11-year-old brother and his grandma, Pam Cantrell. She says they moved here after getting an eviction notice.
The landlord decided to sell the property, and we just could not find a place that we could afford. The more I looked, the more depressed I got. I didn't know what to do.
Cantrell gets a small disability stipend from the government, but that's nowhere near enough to cover rent in Boise. Cantrell is grateful for the shelter, but says it's hard on her grandsons.
My youngest one, he can be a little terror because he's upset by it, you know. He gets angry, and then he'll sit in the corner, and he'll just say, I hate this place, I hate this place.
And so later on in that story, Caden talks about how he really wants to get a job. And his grandma's just like, no, you've got to be a kid for a while. And that story struck a chord. But I think it's also another one of those that's like, we need to hear from people who are directly experiencing growth in a way that's not just from our political officials, right? I still think about them a lot.
I think for me as an editor, it was a really good example of knowing that I have to be patient with my reporters. I mean, sometimes a story's going to take a long while because we need that right voice. And I remember with that particular piece, it did take a while. But I knew that I could count on Amanda because you have a real knack for that, for finding the perfect voices like Tammy, like Caden. And that paid off. You know, the other end of the spectrum is... Right, Nate, sometimes it doesn't pay off. Do you want to share when it doesn't pay off?
Yeah, so I was working on a story for, it feels like forever, probably 3 months, about Grand Canyon. So in October, there was a sudden announcement that the head of Grand Canyon National Park, the woman who was brought in to clean up a culture of sexual harassment there, had suddenly and hastily been reassigned and was under federal investigation, and the Interior Department was keeping quiet about it. And so immediately you start hearing rumors about everything, and it's just like, as a reporter, as a listener, when you hear something like that, you're like, what's happening? You know, that's really intriguing. So I started talking to a lot of people, and in our line of work, you speak to a lot of folks on background, and on background means we're not recording this. I just want to find out more about this story. And so people of power love to talk to you on background. They love to talk to you off the record. They hate talking to you on the record. And so you hear all of these things. And so we went down to Grand Canyon, and I started corroborating some of these rumors, finding out what had actually happened, and it was pretty juicy stuff. It's very juicy stuff.
Which we can't share
because we're missing one puzzle piece, and that one puzzle piece won't speak with us. And so that's the kind of thing is that you'll hear from very, very legitimate sources within the federal government telling you legit things that you've heard from three or four other sources that you can't use because they're not willing to put their name on the line for those kind of stories. And so that was, for me, that was a crash course in how I guess, I mean, in a way, how D.C. works, but how our federal government and bureaucracy works. And this is a long way of saying that when you see anonymous sourcing in places like the New York Times, the Washington Post, and NPR, you know, there's a lot of work that goes behind finding those sources. And, I mean, I don't want to say you can trust all of them, but you can definitely trust our anonymous sources.
And sometimes you get so mired in stories like that, you just need to go hunting.
Yeah, absolutely. Oh. Yeah, sometimes you just...
Good segue.
Yeah, it was a very good segue.
Do you want to talk about your story?
Yeah, there's times where you're spending 3 months just grinding into frustration on stories that end up turning into three tiny little stories that nobody cares about. And then other times you're like, I just really want to go hunting and or I want to learn how to hunt and I want to do it with my dad. So I grew up in rural Wisconsin. Around kids that would go out every, you know, on opening weekend, they would go hunting. We were from the coast. We were from British Columbia, Vancouver Island, not a hunting family. And so I dragged my dad along to go hunting with me, and we're going to hear a little bit of that story.
It's kind of weird seeing my dad cut into the neck of a dead cow elk. My dad's name is Mike. He's a software engineer, and he's never hunted before. But now his blue latex gloves are bloody as he peels fur and skin off the animal.
Do you feel grossed out at all?
No, it's a lot like, actually, look a lot like getting ready for smoking ribs.
Really?
Way. Yeah, yeah, you're separating out some pieces to it. So,
even though there's this like giant elk's head right next to my foot.
My dad seems to be handling this way better than I am. I dragged him to the middle of Idaho for this 3-day intensive workshop. It's put on by the sportsman's group Backcountry Hunters and Anglers. So far, we've learned hunting rules and regulations, how to track an elk, and now how to butcher one. The elk is sprawled out on a tarp in a parking lot, and there's this rank smell coming from her neck. I'm getting a little queasy. Our instructor is Eric Crawford. He smells it too.
It's probably literally food still sitting in there that's kind of partly decomposing and giving you that sour smell.
That's kind of gross. But that's okay.
These are the things I've got to get over if I want to learn how to hunt.
It was a really gross smell. And so, like, in those kind of stories, too, you're kind of positioning yourself a little bit as the foil in the room, like the dumb guy. And, I mean, in a normal circumstances, would I voice every thought that's going through my head? Probably not. But for a story like this, I want to take you to that place, and I want you to know what it sounds like, what it smells like, things like that. And so I'm often the guy sitting there with this big fluffy microphone talking to myself and then talking to you and then talking to myself again about it. And so you look pretty weird, but you get stuff like that.
Well, that's how you take notes sometimes too. You know, like, okay, there's a crowd in the room and I see 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 8 people wearing blue coats. And then if you need to write that into a web story later on, you can't. I mean, that'd be a boring story. I'm just kind of using what I see here. But yeah, you can narrate and that becomes part of the story if you need that scene.
What was the other thing you were thinking of doing, Nate? Because we were saying we should have a series of all the things Nate
things Nate wants to do in the West. Hunting was one, which I don't think I'll do. I think I'll just stick with fishing. I want to ride a horse. I haven't ridden a horse in probably 10 years.
A wild horse, maybe.
Yeah. So I wanted to do a wild horse story. ride a horse. If you guys have other ideas of things Nate should do.
You can tweet us.
Tweet us
with ideas for Nate to do. Exactly. Nate, you were going to talk a little bit about challenges of our region, right?
Yeah, so, you know, reporting in the Mountain West, obviously we all, I'm assuming most of us live in the region, so we know that, you know, we count drives in hours and not miles, and 7.5 hours, you know, that's a day's drive, what's doable. And a lot of times in our stories, you know, we have to push 7-8 hours to, so for instance, I had to do a story on Keystone XL, which is an oil pipeline in eastern Montana. At the time, I was living in Missoula, which is here, and eastern Montana is here. And so I drove, you know, took off, drove across the state, got to this little tiny dining room, this little tiny diner, met with this sheriff, and we had like a half an hour conversation. And I was just thinking to myself, I just drove like the length of 3 East Coast states to talk to this guy for a half an hour.
The other day, actually for that rancher story that I was doing, I drove for 3 hours, and the final directions to get to his property were turn on the dirt road, set your odometer, follow the power lines for 9 miles, and then you'll be there. like, okay, well, there's not a sign. I hope it's the right way, and it was. So,
and the other thing I think as reporters is you really have to be prepared. Because you don't want to go back. We had one of the Salt Lake reporters filled in and did a story for us down in San Juan County, which I know 6-7 hours from Salt Lake, Nate, something like that.
To get to where he was, he had to go nine.
Yeah, and he drove all the way there, and there was this crucial piece of tape he was supposed to get, and he forgot. So I had to send him all the way back. He was not happy, but it was a lesson. It was a lesson, right?
And then occasionally we're going into, well, There's, I think, a trope and a stereotype that people in conservative-leaning places don't trust the media, especially in kind of the atmosphere that we've been living in recently. So first off, I'd say that I would 99% of the time when I go report in rural places or whether it's a ranch, you know, way out on some gravel road, or it's a small town in the middle of eastern Montana, people are always very willing and happy to speak with me. They might say, you know, so-and-so is fake news, but, you know, you're not fake news. And so I appreciate that. But there are occasional moments where you do go in and you are uncomfortable. And the only time I've been really uncomfortable was when I was covering one of the Trump rallies in Montana. It was the one where he was in Missoula. And I was next to Jim Acosta, and there was this group of like 5 or 6 guys that were just like making body slamming motions at him. And it was just a really, I mean, part of it's theatrics, you know, when they turn around and everybody boos the media and they point at you. I just hadn't experienced that before. And so that was a little bit shaky. I would say that was the only time I really felt in an uncomfortable situation. Mm-hmm.
I mean, I covered the occupation of the Malheur National Wildlife Refuge in my role at Oregon Public Broadcasting before I came here, and that was the occupiers there were very distrusting of the media and talked a lot about what they disliked about mainstream media. And in some ways, it was an opportunity for me to say, like, "Hey, I'm a reporter, and here I am. Here's how I approach my work." And to build some trust with some people who like to talk about how they don't trust the media. But I also take that as an opportunity to point out that mainstream media is something you hear a lot about. But what is mainstream media? We're thousands of reporters, hundreds of thousands of reporters probably across the U.S., each with our own lives and our own perspectives and our own editors, frankly, who are telling us how to report. So the idea that there's this conglomerate of people who are driving an agenda to me is just crazy because, you know, every day I get a chance to visit with my editor and we figure out what stories we're going to do, and that's how we work. But in any case, talking about challenges of producing stories in this region, we were going to also talk about an important story about gerrymandering.
Oh, yeah.
Bring us to that.
This was a story that Ray Bushell did out of Colorado. It was during the election or just before the election, and we realized that two of our states had gerrymandering initiatives on the ballot. So I was like, we're going to have to do gerrymandering on the radio. And it's hard enough writing about gerrymandering and explaining it, you know, in print, where the reader can go back and say, oh, I didn't quite get that. I'll go back and I'll figure out again what this gerrymandering thing is. So we were trying to figure out how to do it on the radio, and we played around with a lot of ideas, and hopefully this worked. I don't know if you've got it queued up.
Aside from an exceptional amount of pigeon poop, this street corner in Denver looks totally normal, deceptively normal.
There are buses crossing, there are cars zooming by.
That's Amanda Gonzalez, and she knows something that the people waiting to cross this street don't. That when they step off this curb, they are walking the plank, crossing an invisible precipice.
The invisible line isn't discernible from any other place on this corner.
It's the line that separates a district represented by one politician from a district represented by another. And people don't seem to give a pigeon poop about it.
Hi, did you know that you're standing on the line between District 31 and 34?
It doesn't make any difference to me, sorry.
Nope. Never really concerned me. Just crossing Colfax Broadway.
These lines are everywhere, crisscrossing through cities and fields, sometimes cutting right between neighboring houses in a gated community. And Gonzalez says they're really important. She's the executive director of Colorado Common Cause. It's one of many groups backing a measure in Colorado that wants to drastically change who draws those lines.
Hopefully, after November, the people drawing that line will be people just like you and me. Right now, it's largely politicians that draw it.
Okay, so hopefully that worked and everybody has had an epiphany and understands gerrymandering. I don't know. I'm going to jump quickly. We want time for questions if there are any questions. So I'll jump quickly to another piece that Ray did. And this is an example of the boring but important story again, which we do frequently. It's our thing, right? And this story, it was during the election, and it was about electing coroners. And, you know, many of you probably know in regions across the country, and certainly in our region, you elect a coroner along with everything else. And it's sort of a, you know, at the bottom of the ballot, who cares? You know, in 2016, we were looking at Clinton, Trump, you know, coroner, not so interesting. So we were trying to figure out how are we going to get people engaged at the beginning of the story so that they want to know what this story is about. And this is what we did.
Imagine medieval England.
Bring out your dead!
Life expectancy was abysmal. The plague was killing people left and right. Monty Python might be taking it to the extreme here.
I'm not dead.
Yeah. He says he's not dead.
Yes, he is.
I'm not.
But maybe not by much.
Not. You'll be stone dead in a moment.
Oh, I can't.
This is where and when the people in charge of determining who was legally dead and how they died came to be, a.k.a. the coroner. Coroners, or crowners, were representatives of the king. They were in charge of investigating suspicious deaths and of confiscating people's property sometimes for the monarch. Fast forward about 800 years, and coroners are still around today, right here. And in counties across the U.S., just like it was in medieval England, there aren't a lot of requirements for the position.
We had a bit more tape to play, but I think we're running out of time, right? So I don't know if there are questions or...
Let's open it up. In the meantime, we did get one on Twitter that I think would be interesting to address from Ethan. Ethan writes, as a transplant to the region... How do I know what personal interests and experiences of mine might be relevant to the community in a storytelling setting? So just in general, how do we know what people's experiences might be interesting for our reporting purposes, our storytelling purposes? I'll start with that and say I think a lot of our own experiences are very important to the news and very important to the storytelling. If you're a gardener, if you're a mother or a father with kids in school, there are education stories, there are native plant stories. Your experience can absolutely contribute to how we tell the stories of the day. So I think if you feel compelled and want to share what's going on in your life, we always love to hear from you. But I also think you can think about how your life is connected to the issues of today. Maybe you experienced a rent increase, or maybe you're trying to buy a house in Boise, and you know the prices of today are making it impossible. That's relevant for a reporter to hear about. You want to add to that?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's the big thing. The two kind of things we look at is, you know, does this affect a lot of people or is it just really, really interesting? And I think anything, a lot of times what you do is you'll hear a story and then you'll kind of see, well, how does that connect regionally? Why does somebody in Laramie or why does somebody in Rhode Island care about what you're experiencing right now? And I think in terms of our medium, in terms of what we're doing as news stories, that's the question that we have to ask every time.
Okay, we have a question from John, and he said, how do you tie stories together to report on larger trends and issues, e.g. climate, public lands, fire, etc.? I think that's reminded me of something that we didn't get into. Yes, we cover a lot of climate change story because it keeps popping up, and you worry sometimes, are we covering it too much? You know, there's fatigue, right? It's depressing. You know, the other thing that we're doing is we're planning over the next year, we're going to do a sort of sporadic series called Climate Solutions. And we're going to go out into the community. We're going to talk to, you know, government officials, to local leaders, to regular folks, to kids, to school teachers, anybody, and say, what are you doing? You know, some positive stories, some positive change in dealing with climate change so it's not all doom and gloom. That's the plan.
You have been listening to Big Stories of the Mountain West. On the panel, managing editor Kate Concannon, reporter Nate Hedgie, and Amanda Peacher, who covers Idaho for the Mountain West News Bureau. The panel discussion held at StoryFort 2019, hosted by Boise State Public Radio. You can find stories from the Regional Consortium when you click the News tab at boisestatepublicradio.org. Also at the site, you can find this panel discussion for on-demand listening. Click the Programs tab and select Community Conversations at boisestatepublicradio.org.